I had no money. I was super broke. I had no skills in coding or being a doctor. I was also pregnant.
Wow.
I had the idea and I started researching and I didn't want to commit. It's hard to commit to an idea. And now I know what it is like to commit to an idea.
The impact that Clue has had is absolutely profound. Over 10 million users.
When I speak to women who are thinking about founding companies, they will often list this whole long list of why they can't start the company. And look at this list and I'm like, wow, they're all about not being ready or smart enough, or educated enough, or networked enough. Scrape all that. Seriously. Just start. Then you learn. You learn every day.
If you were to go back when you started Clue, what was the story leading up until this point? Today, we are joined by Ida Tin, co-founder and chairwoman of Clue, the groundbreaking women's health app that has empowered over 10 million users across 190 countries to track and understand their reproductive health. Ida didn't just build a startup, she built an entire industry. Yes, we're speaking today with the pioneer of the term femtech before it was known as femtech. And Ida continues to shape this $60 billion market. Ida's journey has been anything but conventional. Ida, it is so lovely to have you.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe we can just go into it. If you were to go back when you started Clue, did it pan out how you thought it would? What was the story leading up until this point?
So I wanted to try and build a home diagnostics to start with. I wanted to be able to measure hormones in saliva. And fair to say, did not succeed building that. Gave up on that after 4 years. But my co-founder, he said, we should build a peer tracking app as a way to get into this field while we build the hardware. And that was very smart because while we were failing building the hardware, we understood that we could actually do what we wanted to do on this data-only platform and much more. So definitely, I didn't know what would lie ahead. I think maybe sometimes it's a good thing that you don't know exactly what's ahead, because it's an endless learning journey, right? There's always something new that you're doing for the first time. It's also what makes it fun.
Were there any personal experiences that led to the company's creation?
He was reading this question of, hold on, why has there been no innovation in family planning methods since the pill came out in the late 50s, like in the history of technology? That's a very long time ago. And I was a little bit pissed. I was like, why is nobody caring about this? This is like a super like central thing for every single woman and for us as a species on this planet. So I wanted to be able to take out my phone and it should just tell me, today you cannot become pregnant, or today you can. That's simple. I thought, how hard can that be? It was pretty hard, it turned out. But Clue did get FDA clearance as the world's first 100% data-driven type of birth control in 2021. But we built many things. It wasn't like we were trying to only do that for 10 years. We would definitely have failed as a startup. But that was one big goal I had, to see if we could do something in the space of family planning.
You mentioned that you did the hormone health app before then it pivoted into Clue. Did you build anything before? What was your life before entering this crazy world of entrepreneurship, or has it always been there?
I guess I've always been an entrepreneur. My first company was, this is a weird story. I literally got lost at a university building in London and I ended up in some office and they were waiting to interview a candidate for a course. I knew I was not the applicant. They knew I was not the applicant, but we had the interview nevertheless. It was totally surreal. And so suddenly I had come there because I wanted to study art, and suddenly I had enrolled myself into an entrepreneurship course for people in the creative arts. I didn't really know what it was. So the first day I showed up, they're like, so what's your business idea? And I just said, crystal bead jewelry. I don't know why I said that. I just had to say something. And so I built a company doing jewelry. And I learned in these 6 months that I did not want to be in the fashion industry, but I had earned enough money that I could go to Mexico with my boyfriend at the time and we could buy 2 motorcycles and travel around for 6 months. So that was my first business. It was super random. Never became an artist, and then did a very creative business school in Denmark called the Chaos Pilots. And then after I graduated, I literally sat in a small room trying to figure out what to do with my life, like a whole year. I would write long lists and I would think and I would think. And in the end of that year, I was like, okay, I get it. You cannot think, you have to do. Mm-hmm. And then my dad at the time, he was between careers and he wanted to do something new. And we were both like, what are we going to do with our lives? And then we were like, let's make motorcycle journeys because we know about how to do motorcycle tours. Because that had been my childhood and his life. And so I did that for 5 years. And it was really a lot of fun, travel the world. And out of these 5 years, I spent 2 years riding my own motorcycle around the US, just as a kind of why not interesting thing to do. And then at the end of that, I was like, okay, if I keep doing this, I will one, end up in an accident, and two, it's incompatible with having a family, which I wanted to start. And three, it was not my life calling to do motorcycle tours. It was a lot of fun, but I was like, and then this question came up, like, why is family planning so broken? And I thought, okay, I'm going to do something. And I had literally nothing. I had no money. I was super broke. I had no skills in coding or being a doctor. I was also pregnant.
Wow.
And I had a post-it note. I put it on my wall. I was like, that's going to be my role. And then I took all the business cards I had ever gathered from random people, and I put them on the wall, and I made this sort of fantasy team. I was like, oh, these people maybe could help with this. And it was pure fantasy. I don't think I ever contacted any of these people on these, but it just gave me the sense of there could be an organization. And I could be the one just like holding this vision, because that was pretty much the only skill I had, I think. In the end, you always hire people who are better than you for everything. That's how it happened.
So you coined the term femtech, as Maria mentioned earlier. So when you set out to start the company, what were some of the things that you had to think about? What was the landscape like? How did you have to change the way in which people viewed women's health?
One thing I noticed was that we had a hard time describing in words what our company was doing. Because yes, we were peer tracking it, but we were so much more. We were doing science work. We were also helping people with other stages of their lives, doing educational content. So it was not easy to find the right words. And I was going to be on this panel for TechCrunch Disrupt in San Francisco in 16. They were doing the first panel ever on female health. And I was looking what the other panelists were building and how they were describing themselves. And I was like, wow, they also have language all over the place. And I thought, but we are like neighbors. Like, we are building in the same field, even though you are doing whatever, breast pumps, and I'm doing period tracking. We are still sort of sisters. And I thought, what if we had a term that could make it easier for us to find each other, easier for people to talk about what we're building, and honestly also make it easier for male investors to be like, I'm considering doing an investment into a femtech company rather than I'm looking at this company helping women not to pee in their pants. That's difficult. So yeah, that was how it started, the sense of we need better language here and we need to find each other and it needs to not be so difficult to talk about these things.
Interesting. And what was the leap like when you figured out that, okay, periods are a good way to go in? What was that 0 to 1? What was your journey? We asked this because I think there are quite a few people who are in very different stages of that spectrum. Some are still mulling on the idea. Some are just about to take the leap. Some have just. So what was your story going from 0 to 1? Idea, was the original name Clue? What was it?
It was BioWink. Like biology would give you a wink and be like, today. My co-founders thought that sounded like a biotech company and we wanted to be consumer facing. They're like, no good. And I think I had this like notebook with name ideas and I think I had her Clue and they're like, what if it was just Clue? Mm-hmm. We discussed this for a couple of days and we're like, okay, let's go for this. And can you get a new, like a website domain that's okay and all these other considerations. But I think the biggest, hardest 0 to 1 moment is to decide, yes, I'm going to do this. I had the idea and I started researching and I think somehow I didn't want to commit. It's hard to commit to an idea. And now when I know what it is like to commit to an idea, it's, yeah, that's going to be like a 10-year marathon. Be careful. But the idea just would not leave my system. It would not leave my head. Like at some point, it was not even a decision. It was like bowing down to a decision that somehow had been made. I was like, I have to do this. I have to try to do this. Then I started talking to investors, actually. That was one of the first things I did at the Technical University in Copenhagen. that a venture fund, and I thought, oh, I'll go talk to them about my biotech idea. And honestly, now I think, what did I talk about? I didn't have anything. I had no business model. I had written nothing down. I had no team. I had no market research, nothing. And I just talked about why this would be a great idea and somehow got to the next meeting. And in the end, when I then understood their sort of financial investment model, I was like, what? I'm going to give you this much of a company and I'm going to get this little money? No way, I don't want this. So the 0 to 1 is just actually the first step. Then there's always the next step and the next step and the next step. It's like a puzzle piece. You pull in little pieces and you have no idea how big this puzzle piece is going to ever be. And that's good because you would probably be overwhelmed if you knew. Mm. You don't have to know everything. But when I speak to women who are thinking about founding companies, they will often list this whole long list of why they can't quite yet start the company. Mm. And I look at this list and I'm like, wow, they're all about yourself not being ready or smart enough, or educated enough, or researched enough, or networked enough. Scrape all that. Seriously. The biggest hindrance to start is often, I think, women themselves. Just start. Then you learn. Learn every day.
There's this saying, there's clarity in execution. It's one of the sayings I love the most. Because
I should have known that when I grew up. It's year.
So it's what you're saying, right? Like, you don't need to figure it all out. Just get it started and then you figure it out as you go. But how do you... So it sounds like for you, it was an earworm. You couldn't... It was something you had to do. And then you started. You had conversations with these investors. What did they say? At what point were you like, you know what? I'm just going to go do this, even if... Or did you have investors come on board? Walk us through how you navigated that initial conversation with investors to the first version of the product.
Yeah, and I guess just to add to that, I'm really curious how you went about fundraising at a time when it wasn't an overlooked space. To me, it's crazy. When I first started out investing shortly after you would have started in 2015, femtech was considered a niche, despite the fact that we're 50% of the population. And so I'm just curious how you navigated that in the early days, just given that it was overlooked by a lot of investors.
It was hard to fundraise. It's still hard to fundraise. And I still see women and men building femtech struggling. Well, I didn't fundraise alone. I should say that. I fundraised with a guy. I think that was probably quite helpful because a lot of the first money came from angels and through network and kind of him and us being good at being out and meeting people and being visible in media. And as I was fundraising, at some point, I would be like, why is this not working? Like, it doesn't make sense. I knew that was then a little bit later, but I knew we had good product. I knew that people liked it. I knew the team was good. And the numbers, like, I knew. And still, we would just get no after no. And I was like, there is some hidden X here, some invisible factor. And I have had that confirmed many times, I think, through my own journey and other people's journeys. There is actually something that doesn't make sense, that you don't get the funding. And I think one of the reasons why this invisible X is a factor is because a lot of fundraising is a very human and social thing. You would think it's a business conversation, but very often it's, does this person have a random story with a female in their life where they knew something, or did his friend also say something so they have social proof, or... And also just, will they trust you? Here you come, you look different from them. You have a set of life experiences they can never share. How will they trust you? They're putting their own name on the line, people's money. So I think the sort of social fabric of it is important. And one of the reasons why it was helpful to have a male also to fundraise, because you're disrupting the whole social fabric just by walking through the door. It's difficult. And I actually wrote this guide to how to invest into femtech a couple of weeks ago that I will put out sometime soon.
Oh, I can't wait to read it.
It's like we keep talking about high pitch training and what you're going to wear and how comfortable and confident are you going to look, and do you need new glasses because the other ones look silly and all of this. But in the end of the day, it's no, we need to train the people listening, because there's so much bias in how we listen. There's so much pattern recognition that is not helpful when you're trying to like see a new pattern, because it's a new type of leader. they have a different way of expressing what a great leader will be, what it looks like to be ambitious and confident. So, yeah, need to train the VCs, and they need to look like you.
Yeah. You think that helped in your journey? Were there many female investors when you were fundraising for Clue, and did that help?
Listen, had there not been really brave males, Clue would never have existed. My four co-founders were all male. I would say probably the 80% of our investors have been male. It was not like, oh, these women sprang out of the wood and came and let's do this together at the early days of Clue. No, it was some very brave men who were like, oh yeah, this makes sense, let's try this.
Yeah. Fast forward, looking at where Clue is today, you have millions of users all over the world. What do you think's been really key to Clue's success?
It's such a multi-sided thing that has to come together for this ball to roll. Are you building something that actually is helpful? And do you do it in a way that's emotionally tuned in enough that it will feel right to people? In brackets, one of the problems when only males build femtech, it just ends up feeling a little off. Very off. So, like, that report with the users, because in the end, everything starts and ends with the user, right? They are actually the core characters of this whole story. But then, are you honoring people's trust when you ask for very sensitive health data? Mm. Are you building a business model that is transparent and fair, and you don't make the users the product, but actually have a business model that is ethically okay?
Yeah.
Do you have a brand that feels good, I guess? Whatever way a brand needs to feel good for different products. For us, it was really important to be very inclusive. No matter how you describe your gender or where on the planet you live, let's just talk about our bodies, right? We share bodies, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, the product has to work. It has to not be too buggy. It's never done. And you need to not run out of money.
Oh. That's a good one, not running out of money.
Yeah.
For Clue, the data is a big part of how your ethos of building Clue, that data privacy, not selling, like just protecting the data of the users. Where did that come from? Was that always there? What's your thesis and ethos behind that? Given it's very hard to build a consumer product that needs a part of it to be free, and not also then lean too much into the data ads piece. So please tell us a little bit about how you thought about that.
It was absolutely part of our DNA of wanting to be trustworthy. And luckily, building trust is hard and it can easily be lost. And it's something you build over time by doing the right thing every single time. I'm so happy you cannot buy trust because we would be totally screwed as consumers. And so when we started building the app, we didn't feel we had the team or the resources to build a bag that was absolutely 100% as safe as we could make it. So we didn't ask for data that would only make sense if we had a bag and we could store it and process it and give something back. So we didn't want that data. We give something back. So I think that's another principle. Don't ask for more data than what you can give back to the users in some meaningful, valuable way. Then eventually we felt, okay, now we can build this and we can ask for more data. Then, of course, writing the terms of service and the privacy statement so people can actually understand it. We wrote blog posts about what happens to your data when you enter it. Hey, by the way, what's the connection between advertisement and money and data? You should all know this. One of our big competitors, two legal lawsuits, or I've had first in America, then in Canada, because they did not do what they had written in their own privacy statement. They shared too much data back to networks, but really trying to help people actually understand what's going on with this data. Then GDPR came into Europe. We were almost in full compliance just because that's how we were thinking it. And then another thing was that when we started, the kind of ethos in venture capital was just grow, and we'll figure out monetization later. So we also did that. We didn't have a business model. We tried different things. We're like, oh, what if it just costs €1 or $1? Everybody can pay that. Guess what? They didn't want to pay if they could use the free product. That was almost the same. But we wanted it to be free because we wanted people to have this education content. And then slower at a time, you build more behind the paywall. So it makes more sense for people to pay for the premium. Mm-hmm. And then it shifted in the venture capital world. And then suddenly they're like, guys, you got to have to make money and you have to make it now. And it was hard to raise money. So then that becomes more of a focus, which means, for instance, that the birth control kind of thing we had worked on That's a long, slow, really careful, regulated, heavy thing to build. Ah, God, we got to build something that can make us revenue faster. We shelved that. So find your way, but that's how we did it. And I am so proud of the team there, how they have just, there's so much tinkering in getting a subscription model to work on a consumer product in a sector where you can get a lot for free. But we did not want an advertisement, and we did not want to sell data, and we want to always be able to look users in the eyes, and they should know exactly how we make money.
I
And
love that.
it has to feel okay.
Yeah, I think generally consumers hard, right? Getting your product in the hands of consumers is no easy feat. Very curious how you approached the go-to-market in the early days. What sort of growth hacks did you use? Any tips for any of our consumer founders out there listening to this?
I remember we had bought 3 minutes to be on stage at a tech conference in San Francisco. And then we launched and we were like super excited. And then we had the first day, we had 7,000 downloads. And we were just like thrilled, right? I was like, what? 7,000 people have downloaded this app. What do we do now? And then actually one of the first hires, a really bright, smart woman from the US, she said, there is a thing called YouTubers. We should try to work with some of these YouTubers. And we're like, okay, I didn't know anything about YouTubers. And she was just brilliant in getting us then onto influencer marketing, which of course it's called now. And we did that for some time and we got really good cost per install numbers. But then as we switched to trying to build more of an audience where people had more willingness to pay, more ability to pay, and then they people convert more on Apple than they do on Android, then we had to adopt a little bit more or different growth tactics. It's not rocket science in terms of figuring out what they might be. It's hard to do well, but of course, digital ads is like not the ones that people see in the product, but the ones they might see when they scroll on YouTube or Google somewhere else or in their app stores.
Yeah. Now we're going to do something slightly different. So we actually have a dilemma that's coming from one of our listeners. So I'm going to just read that out. So, hi, Ida. I'm a huge fan of your work at Clue. You're an inspiration, especially for founders like me who are building in the femtech space. I'm the founder of Luna, the teen health and well-being app that provides medically backed information to help teens navigate that transition to adulthood, covering topics like periods, mood tracking, hormones, and reproductive health. Ultimately, building healthy habits and teens' interest in women's health for their bodies when they start changing. We've grown to over 100,000 engaged users globally, many of whom rave about the product. We've raised a pre-seed round from family and friends and few funds, which wasn't easy. Now, as we gear up for the seed round, we're facing a challenge. While we know we're building a category-defining company, we have captured the interest of a new audience and built a product teens and they are obsessed about. But investors keep pushing for more revenue and traction. Some numbers they're quoting feel unachievable with the resources we have. At the same time, we're seeing male founders in femtech or mentech or just male founders in generally seemingly raise capital effortlessly. Honestly, it can be frustrating. What advice do you have on navigating the fundraising landscape for us at the seed stage? How would you suggest we position ourselves for investors who may not fully grasp the long-term potential of what we're building?
Oh man, I remember once I wrote one of my investors and I'm like, this juice machine company just raised like some drizillion amount, and here I am doing like some of the most foundationally important work in the world, and I cannot raise my little amount. And he was like, yes, sometimes it's opposite correlated, like the importance of the innovation and how much money they raise. And I found some solace in that. Honestly, I want to say this again, Ben. It does not make sense. You will see things where it doesn't make sense. It's just stupid. It is literally stupid that people don't invest into women's health because we know there's money to be made. So how do you come about that? I would say, I don't know the pitch, of course, but one of the challenges is that you sit across a person who's curious, yeah, whatever, like you don't, it doesn't feel important. Build a story that somehow has the full weight of how big a deal this is. Whether you need to make it like use analogies or metaphors or more emotional, tell the person like whatever it takes, but have people feel like, whoa, this is a real thing. Wow, this is, it really is important in people's lives. And then build a really big story. Do you know how many teenagers there is on this planet? Oh my gosh, that's a lot of teenagers. Imagine if they all had this product in the pocket. What access would you have to their lives? And by the way, what else could we use this for? If you want to go down the investor, tickle their fantasy a bit, but tell a bigger story, make it something that people can relate to. Also really have a very kind of hardcore look at your own business model. Maybe it's not good enough. That's also a possibility. If the product cannot grow, do you really know why? Is it really only the marketing spend, or is it something else? For instance, if you only cater to a short span of people's lives, you're just going to have more churn. That's going to make you have to get so many people through the door all the time because they keep not being teenagers anymore. Do you want to pick up these users and take them somewhere else? Or like, that's like a challenge in their specific case. Maybe at least have good answers for that, or does that become part of the business model in some creative way? Or
thank you. That is so interesting, because I have a few founders. For disclosure, I invested in Luna a few years ago when we just started. Right. And it's interesting because the pitch to me was exactly what you said. There are teenagers in the world. I think there are 3 billion. And that's like an LTV of maybe 6 years, which is a lot longer than most consumer LTV if you think about it. Mm. And this is a supply of people that are just never going to stop. We're always going to have teenagers and we're always going to have these issues. Mm-hmm. And more and more, I kept thinking, if you think of the way we, in our time, transitioned into adulthood, the information was not there. Now we live in a world that's highly digital, lots of misinformation. In my mind, I was just like, I would want my daughter or child to have something like this in the world, because the world is so different from where we started.
Yeah.
But you've highlighted a few things that, just to recap for anyone listening and also the founder of Luna who wrote in, is almost that story, really bigging up the story essentially, and really being almost very direct about the size of the opportunity and mm-hmm. how this could be influential on a more commercial basis, like to the investors, and what that can mm-hmm. unlock for the future. I think you also mentioned really taking a strong look at the business model, looking at it in the face and seeing what's working and what isn't working. And maybe this is a nice segue into your fundraising story. Were there any people in your journey that were meaningful? That pivotal points where it was either one or zero? It was either going to die or...
Yes, yes. Many times. Yes, there was definitely worse. We are trying to make payroll tomorrow. In the early days, it was scary. And definitely we have people that we owe a lot of gratitude to that saved Clue. And then later it's more, wow, this round is really difficult. Can we do an internal round? And people then did that. I'm grateful for that. They also took full advantage. They're investors. Make no mistake. Those were expensive rounds. But yes, and it's often people who have had their own thesis of thinking as investors. Something that they believe is true, meaningful, creating the kind of world they want to live in. And they are thinking for themselves, and they had the courage to go little bit against the sort of normal grain. So I really applaud investors who have their own sort of conviction. I'm still a little bit problem solving for Luna in my mind.
We can make the correction after, but it's an interesting thing. And I also believe that the best companies, at least the most impactful, they're never going to make sense in the moment. I think there's something about counterintuitive insights for the best companies, because if it made sense, everyone would agree. And there's that tension of pushing and the returns of that doesn't quite play out if everyone agreed that it was great. And we all know that groupthink isn't necessarily an indicator of whether or not something is good or not.
I have this image in my head that we have culture, but then there's actually this kind of dark area of culture where we don't see as a collective. And a lot of women's health have lived in this, right? We have experiences in our own body that is not part of mainstream culture. We don't see it on movies. We don't hear it in songs. But then something happens in culture, the cultural space kind of expands a little bit, and then suddenly in this sort of shadow area, there is this new thing that we become aware of. Like, it's like, what? It takes 10 years to get diagnosed with endometriosis? That can't be right. We should change this. Mm-hmm. And then that's where innovation comes in. So when you say it doesn't quite make sense, I think it's like when it's just starting to make sense, or like something is just, huh, what is this? This is also where women build, because they're like, I need this. I cannot wait for this to be different. Or we need to start this fund because these numbers are not moving. whatever, I don't know what motivated you, assuming might be something to do with numbers.
Yeah, good.
So that's why the cultural landscape is so important, and it really influences innovation.
One thing I wanted to ask you was just on the revenue piece, actually. Because now I know, because I'm a premium subscriber of Clue, and I would very happy continue to, because I think it's valuable. But how did you transition? You mentioned that you reduced the price, thinking if it was just $1, everyone would use it. But how did you transition to a product now that has over 10 million users, but then you have a chunk of that people who are actually paying for the product?
Yeah.
And how did you monetize? Any insights there would be really helpful, especially for consumer founders.
It really is this long, very kind of methodical trying out, but it is also adding enough value behind the paywall that it makes sense, and then telling people what the value is, because that's sometimes also hard to communicate. What's the value of seeing your longitude health data? Maybe someday you have a condition, it might be super helpful. I should really give credit to the current team, Rhiannon White, who's the CEO now. She was the product chief earlier. She's just absolutely brilliant in really being so sensitive to what do people care about. One example is that actually a lot of users don't have menstrual, they don't bleed. So this cycle view is a little bit challenging if your health journey is not punctuated by bleeding. And this was something that came up by talking to users, understand this. And then they, being the current team, then built an app experience in Clue where if you don't have that bleeding pattern, it will still be a meaningful, black, accurate, good user experience. And then they went back to everybody who had ever written them and say, hey, I have this problem, and said, hey, now we have actually built this. And I met a woman this week in person, and she said, I got this email from this support ticket I had sent in years ago about this thing. And they remembered me and remembered that I cared about this. And I think that's a part of growth, right? That you actually care about what people need. You ask them, you listen, and you always have too little resource to build your product. That's just a given, no matter what stage you're at. But you please slowly try to make the product more valuable and then encourage people to pay for it.
I love it. Figure out what people value. Put it behind a paywall, continue to be iterative, and over time that improvement actually counts in the long run.
The impact that Clue has had is absolutely profound, over 10 million users. When you look at the market today, what are some of the gaps do you think exist when it comes to women's health?
Oh, so many. We're a cheese onion, not an onion nugget, a Swiss cheese, is what I'm trying to say. Maybe an onion too, I don't know. No, but there are so many areas. I think hormonal health is a big one. Why is it not a real-time data stream we have on our phones? We're like, oh, this is what's happening today with my hormones. Mm-hmm. That would affect our understanding of reproductive health, but also things like maybe mood and skin and sex and many other things. I think that would be a really interesting area to see more innovation in. I feel this whole area of menopause has just been opened, but really, we need basic research and understanding our bodies. We need so many more products and services and corporate programs, like the whole package, to really take care of this area. It's a huge loss for society in terms of human resource and economically that women drop off the workforce because of menopause symptoms. And then there's so many places where we do have tools, but they are bad and broken and old and outdated. We could have modern great tools or the protocols and how we do things. Osteoporosis, when I met a researcher, she had come up with a new protocol that should be standard for how we screen for osteoporosis. She was explaining what we do, and you were just like, what? This is still how we do this? That makes no sense. And so many things need to be rebuilt as well. And of course, we need all the data on women's bodies because we don't have it. So now we're building AI on data sets that are distorting and discriminating again.
Yeah, so many areas left innovating.
One question I had was on the transition of your role. So you transitioned from CEO to the chairwoman, but you're still the co-founder. Talk to us about that. How has it been? How would you talk to founders who maybe later down the line will have to think about that? What was your experience?
Yeah. I had some really quiet voices in my mind, which is, oh, the things I will need to learn to keep being the best CEO that could be for this company doesn't interest me as much. I saw a lot of Excel sheets. I was a bit tired also, and I started noticing that sometimes I would come into meetings with my team and I would not be the one holding the highest bar. I was like, that's not good. That doesn't work. And then there were some internal changes. The COO had just left the company. So either I was going to hire a new COO, or it was a moment where there could also be a new CEO. Got a little bit of hint from the board also. They're like, have you considered this? And it was a bit like, what? But I knew, yeah, it's actually true. And it was amazing. I loved my job. I really did. I felt like the luckiest person on the planet that I got to have this job. Absolutely loved it. But then afterwards, it was like you go from being hyper-focused on one company, and suddenly I was curious about an industry and curious about the industry in the world. And I still love that. And also, I think the team got absolutely amazing CEOs for me. They are much bigger, better, and smarter in so many ways than I am. I'm so proud of them. I think it was good for the company that I left, and I hope I can serve the femtech industry in a way I couldn't as CEO of Clue. So it's all good.
Yeah, so one of the things we love to do before we wrap up is just ask our guests, time machine, if you could go back right at the very beginning of your journey and give yourself one piece of advice, what would that be?
I think the biggest mistakes I made as CEO is when I actually knew, but it was like this quiet voice and I didn't quite have the courage to really trust it. So I would say, trust of what you know.
That gut feel.
Yes. Maybe it's even more of a gut feel. It's like, maybe it's like your values or your ethics or your conviction or your body experience or what your friends are saying. Like, and because you are met with people who don't have that same life experience, and they can pulverize what you knew. Just know, remember what.
Yeah.
And then having the courage to also know that you can shape your organization and your image more, even more. Make it work for you, and do it transparently, opening, invite other people into whatever privileges that you need to have. Whether it's like on Wednesdays, I can't have no meetings on Wednesdays because I need a day to think. Maybe other people need that too. Or I need to do more sports. Why don't we all do more sports on Tuesdays? Or I need to bring my baby to work. You know what? You can also bring your baby to work. Let us agree on how we can do this.
Yeah, and no, I love that.
I love that too.
I try to think what works for you. And I guess an additional question. I know that you've written a book and you're writing this investment guide now that you said we can't wait for it to be released and have a look at it. But along your journey, have there been any key books or individuals that you really looked up to that we could share with our listeners in the show notes, just that you could share as some nuggets of inspiration for them to also look into?
Oh, there are so many things, but I listened a lot to podcasts at some part of my CEO journey. I listened to venture capitalist people speaking. It's like, where is your own learning edge? Keep getting more information in on that edge. I also did a lot of body work. I think that was incredibly important. Actual physical, like, body therapy stuff. I think as a founder, how you stay connected to your own body is a really important part of it. Being able to stand the distance, but make sure to sleep, make sure to eat, make sure to take time off. If you want to be a high performer, you need to rest as well. We have so much sitting in our bodies, work on it. We are bodies. Take care of your body.
That is incredible. It's so funny. Only few founders say this, but when they say this, it's so commonsensical that we forget. It's like, you are your body. If you don't take care of this body, you're not going to be here to actually serve the company or bring out all these visions that you have in your head to reality. But this was great. Thank you so much, and we appreciate you spending your afternoon with us today. It was so lovely to speak with you, Ida.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Leave a review, tell us what you think of this episode on all our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guest. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.